So it's great to be here. Today is such a beautiful day outside. I hope you get a chance to go out and enjoy it. So my name is Khosro Heydari. I'm a chronic disease epidemiologist from South Carolina. The majority of people that are here, I know them personally because they're wonderful people. And you get a chance to see them and hear from them. So by this, I welcome you to our session today. This is Applied Chronic Disease Epidemiology Mentoring Program. It's sponsored by NACDD and CSTE. So we're going to go through this process. It's almost like rapid fire, but in a sort of a good way, not in a negative way. So everybody gets a chance to say something. And with that introduction, I'd like for you to be aware of the fact that, you know, once we start the process, it would be very going. And you may want to ask your question at the end. With that, I'd like to turn that to Dr. Perry. Geraldine is one of our best colleagues and supporters from CDC. She has been a chronic disease epidemiologist for a while at CDC, and we are going to enjoy every moment that we have with her. How about that? I'm going to stop right there.
So I'll start with an overview of the mentoring program. So the purpose of the mentoring program is to enhance chronic disease epidemiology capacity in states by enlarging the pool of trained state-level chronic disease epidemiologists and also improving the practice of chronic disease epidemiology and increase the science in chronic disease program and policy. That last one is very important because if you are trying to work with a program person, you'll understand how important that is because a lot of times they resist the science. So we are trying to help improve that relationship. As you know, in 2009, only about 18% of the state health departments had minimal chronic disease surveillance. And then in 2013, 62% had five or more full-time equivalent chronic disease epidemiologists. And that was up from the 2009 survey, because in 2009, I think it was right at about 50%, less than 50%. So what the 2013 survey assessment identified was about 1,375 more chronic disease epidemiologists were needed, and about 30% of the entry-level and mid-level EPIs in the states who responded to the survey needed additional training in a number of areas. Okay, one of the ways we are trying to increase the capacity in the states is through this program. And as I mentioned, maybe not to this group, but there are three programs that we are trying to increase chronic disease epidemiology capacity in the states through. This is one of them. Another way is through the chronic disease epi assignees that come to the states either as a free assignee to the state or through direct assistance from CDC. And then the third one that we've used is through the CSTE fellowship, those who might be interested in chronic disease epidemiology. But don't let me forget, though, there's a fourth one, which we haven't funded over the last year or so, which is an assignment funding NACDD to assign or assist with paying the salary of a senior-level chronic disease epidemiologist in the states. Erica is one of those people. We had two others, one in Oklahoma, Melinda, what's Melinda's last name? I can't remember her last name. And there was one in Pennsylvania. But through this program, the mentoring program, started in 2011. The actual program started in 2011, but there was a pilot earlier. At that time, in 2011, we had 7 mentees. In 2012, we added another 6 mentees, which are highlighted in the green. And I should tell you that the numbers that you will see are cumulative. In other words, from the first slide, you can see that we had 7. And then in the second slide here, you can see Mississippi had 3 by 2012. By 2013, we now had 20 mentees, and Texas by 2013 had 3, and Alabama had 3, and some additional states. By 2014, we had 27 mentees, and then by that time, Texas had 4, and then we also added Puerto Rico, which is one of the territories. And by 2015, this cohort, we now have mentored 36 mentees and have added another territory, America Samoa. So, as you can see, we are having pretty good coverage, but still we have... All in all, there have only been, I think, 23 states that have been affected, 22 states that have been benefited from the mentorship program, and 2 territories. So our goal is to reach all states, to have coverage in all states. And they are telling me that my time is up.
1 minute.
Okay, very quickly, I just want to point to... bring to your attention that some of our mentees have gone on to do great things. For instance, Erica Walsh, who is in the audience, has become one of our mentors now from the state of Kansas. Jessica Azura is now working as the chronic disease director in Puerto Rico. Namisha Bhakti is now working as a manager in chronic disease in Texas, and with her mentor, she published after she finished the mentorship program. And I think there's one more. Did I miss one, Khosrow? I think I did. But anyway, my time is up. Just the point in that statement was to bring to your attention, our mentorship program is far-reaching. We are still working to have coverage in all states. The mentees, once they finish, are going on to do great things as a result of the mentorship program. Okay. So if you have questions, you can ask me later because my time is up. Okay. I just want to tell you how this is going to happen. There will be an introduction of the mentee by the mentor. The mentor will introduce himself or herself and then introduce her mentee. And then the mentee will go in the order that we've given you the sheet. Okay, so the first person is Megan McDonald. I should introduce Megan because Dr. Agricola Adui is in Africa, and he's her mentor. Megan is an epidemiologist with the Florida Asthma Program and with the Bureau of Chronic Disease Prevention, Division of Community Health. So Megan.
Thank you, Dr. Perry, and good morning, everyone. My mentorship project is entitled Pediatric Asthma Emergency Department Revisits in Florida. Asthma is a leading cause of preventable emergency department visits for children in Florida, and this is also the case in the U.S. Poor asthma management results in repeated visits to the ED, and we know that the ED is not a is an expensive place to receive care. It's not cost effective and it is not sustainable. So the Florida Asthma Program is a CDC-funded comprehensive asthma control program at the Florida Department of Health. And one of the central goals of this program is to reduce preventable ED visits, hospitalizations, and death for Floridians with asthma. My competency area was analytic knowledge, and what I really wanted to do was strengthen my analytic skills, especially in the use of GIS and SAS software to study the burden of this disease in Florida to inform programmatic efforts. And some of the skills I've gained thus far, I've been able to age and sex adjust ED visit rates for asthma in the pediatric population, as well as calculate 30-day asthma ED revisits. I've also mapped ED visits using ArcMap, and I've used GEODIS software to learn how to rate smooth when dealing with small numbers. So the data sources for this project mainly come from the Florida Agency for Healthcare Administration, the ED department patient file, and also population estimates from the Office of Economic and Demographic Research. And again, using GIS, created choropleth maps with ED visit rates and revisit proportions, and also used SAS to compute descriptive statistics, rate standardize, and calculate the revisits. So this is one of the first products that I've created, and these are maps of ED visits, age and sex adjusted in Florida. And you can see over time that these visits overall are increasing. And additionally, we see that there are differences by geography. And so we concluded that there is evidence of geographic disparities in Florida in ED visits for children. And what we ultimately want to do is use these results to guide programmatic planning and direct our resources to areas with the most disparate outcomes of pediatric asthma. And the next steps in this project are to create the ED revisit maps to identify where children are repeatedly coming to the ER. Because if a child comes the second or third time to the ER, that is a missed opportunity to intervene the first time that they were there. So we also would like to know whether the probability of having an ED revisit differs by geography as well. And we'll also be building a statistical model to investigate the risk factors that are associated with 30-day revisits to the ER for pediatric asthma. And ultimately, what we want to do, in addition to using these results to inform programmatic efforts, is to develop and submit a manuscript to a peer-reviewed journal. I would like to thank my mentor, Dr. Agricola Adoy, and also my colleague, Shamariel Robertson, who is a former mentee herself and is an absolute GIS whiz. And she's helped me with learning this software that I had no experience with previously. Thank you very much.
Scott?
Let me introduce him.
I'll just introduce him, right?
Okay, I'm Ann Pabutsky from the University of Hawaii at Manoa, and my mentee is Scott Anisi. He is the territorial epidemiologist for American Samoa. He's doing both chronic disease and infectious disease surveillance and planning, and he was actually recruited from Hawaii, where he was staying in Hilo. After he finished his master's degree, he was working mainly in infectious disease, and he got recruited back to his home island of American Samoa to develop and build their capacity for chronic disease and other surveillance. Scott?
Thank you very much, Dr. Ann. Tala falava, everyone. So there's a nice picture of me and my mentor getting a lot of work done, as you can see. So just a little bit of the geographic location. We are located in the Southwest Pacific, We are the only island chain in the world that boasts the first time zone and the last time zone. So one island is 24 hours ahead of the other islands. 55,000 population, aside from exporting military servicemen and NFL players, we also have our number one export of tuna. So look for us on your shelves here. We've got the best albacore canned tuna that you can find. So our project goals. We wanted to assess the NCD capacity in the region. We wanted to build the database and to kind of figure out what was going on in the territory. The first thing that we evaluated was a needs and resource assessment. We wanted to establish something and come up with a project that was meaningful to the Department of Health and the government, but we didn't know what resources that we had. So the first thing we had to identify was what was currently being done and what type of databases could we utilize. Then we wanted to implement a surveillance plan and develop it for something that's more sustainable and would outlive the mentorship program year. We would see a lot of infectious disease prevalence. So infectious disease was a lot more had a lot more funding. So that capacity was a lot greater than our communicable disease our NCD non-communicable diseases. So we would see that there was a high prevalence of chronic disease, diabetes, heart disease, cancer, a lot of data that showed this. The biggest problem, though, was that the data was over 10 years old. And so we were making claims that we couldn't currently substantiate. So we looked at our behavioral risk factors as one of the first things to develop to see if we had any data on the behavioral risk factors before we went out and focused our project. So we looked at what was done in the region. The WHO had a STEP survey that was done in neighboring Samoa, and it was provided a model for us of something that was done in our region that we could evaluate. There you see a picture of our local taro, which is a staple of our diet. And we saw that we had the BRFSS. BRFSS was relatively new in the territory, and so we had the recommendation to follow examples of other small jurisdictions. So our BRFSS health census, like Palau, or the combined census that's about to roll out in CNMI. Palau's actually here, and Dr. Cash, who's working in CNMI, is here as well. So I'd like to acknowledge them in the crowd, because this is something that we're about to do in the region that's never been done before. So for us, we wanted to localize our sample population and get a complete health census. So we wanted to work in tandem with the home visiting program to provide the biometrics that will go alongside the tool and our survey that we're going to do that's going to combine BRFSS questions and WHO STEPS questions. So this data that we're going to do is not only going to get the incidence and the prevalence, but it's also going to give us a baseline for the data that we're doing. So it's going to be a comprehensive health census, and something that we never had before in the territory, and something that's going to help out all the programs. The other recommendation was to create the surveillance unit in American Samoa. That's the surveillance unit, so that's my staff there. Very healthy looking individuals. And then the last step would be to implement the chronic disease surveillance plan. And that's really what we came up with a timeline. So this mentorship program is really hands-on and intensive for 1 year. But we wanted to provide something that's sustainable, something that we can build on, and something that the department can use. So this is a list of our goals. Right now we're in the first phase. I'm getting together all our traditional leaders, our government partners, our NGOs, and all our community partners to really have a buy-in to this survey. And I think that's the most important part of this. If we don't get community buy-in, then we're going to fail at getting the health census, since we're doing face-to-face, household-to-household. So the step that we're there, and this is a real five-year plan, but once this gets off the ground, we're going to be able to provide data for the department and federally that we've never provided before. So we built a NCD subcommittee that involves all of the pillars: advocacy, lifestyle, surveillance, monitoring, clinical pillars. And we brought them together, but we also brought them together with community members and traditional leaders. So right now we're in negotiations and talks with all of our community partners and trying to get them to buy into the rollout and the importance of this survey. So it's something that is long going. It's very difficult to do at the beginning, but I think if we really get this off the ground, we're going to be able to present some data that a lot of the states have never seen before, and we're going to have to be able to provide numbers from the territories that we've never ever had before. So hopefully we get it done soon. Thank you.
Ask questions at the end.
Thank you. Do you mind also, when you introducing your mentee, do you mind introduce yourself to for a few minutes?
My name is Luis Escobedo. I'm with the New Mexico Department of Health, where I'm a public health physician, and I'm here to introduce Jamiah Clark. Jamiah is the chronic disease epidemiologist with Harris County. She is here to present mortality data from her jurisdiction. Jamiah?
Thank you, Dr. Escobedo. So just to give you a little background, Harris County, some of you may not know what Harris County is, but I'm sure most of you have heard of Houston. Well, Houston is in Harris County. And the population of Harris County is over 4 million residents. And in our county, we actually have two health departments. One is the City of Houston Health Department, as well as my agency, which is Harris County Public Health and Environmental Services. And I'll just refer to my agency as HCFES going from this point on, because as you can tell, it's a very long name. But primarily in the state of Texas, and this may be similar for other states, but chronic disease activities is primarily done at the state level. So it's really important for our county to have those sub-county, that sub-county data, just because Harris County is very unique, it's very diverse, and so to have a better picture of the chronic disease burden at the community level is really helpful. But also with our county, we also want to know, as far as like jurisdiction-wise, what's going on in HCFES jurisdiction, as well as the Houston Health Department would like to also know what's going on in theirs. So to give a little background also, my position, which is a chronic disease epidemiologist, is fairly new. And in addition to my position, we also recently created the Nutrition and Chronic Disease Prevention Program. So this data and this project will really help our agency to provide a better picture of what's going on in the county, but also help with decision making. So in this project, I actually looked at six causes of death, being cancer, cardiovascular disease, coronary heart disease, diabetes, homicides, and pedestrian deaths. But I'm only presenting on the latter two for the sake of time. In addition to looking at and calculating rates for these causes of deaths, I also look at them geospatially. So there are several data sources for this project. The first and the primary is the mortality data that was received from the Texas Department of State Health Services. And I looked at the primary or the underlying cause of death looking at the ICD-10 codes. And you will notice what the ICD-10 codes that I use for pedestrian and homicides. I also used the 2000 Census Bureau data, which was used to calculate the rates. And because I am looking at these causes of death at the sub-county level, I decided to use the community areas that were defined by the University of Texas School of Public Health, Health of Houston survey. And how these community areas were created were using or combining multiple zip codes. And for analysis, I used SPSS version 22 and ArcGIS 10.3 for analysis. So So presented, well, hopefully you can see that, but presented are the two maps for the two causes of death. And one thing that I would like to highlight is that you'll notice a somewhat of a cluster in the eastern part of the county. And although looking at the rates of homicides, although those two conditions are not related, you can see somewhat of a similar pattern of the homicides being clustered towards the eastern part of the county. And so after I did some exploring these counties in general, I noticed that majority of those communities were minority, under poverty, and they also had other social conditions that they were faced with. So to wrap this up, the biggest thing that I'm going for is to obtain new mortality data. And so I'm in the process of acquiring IRB to get that data. But I also want to look at different community levels because I'm not necessarily sure that the existing community areas are the best ones. I'm leaning more towards census tracts. I also have proposed to do additional analysis such as age-adjusted rates, life expectancy, and years of potential life lost. And finally, a part or a major advantage of this mentorship is that I will be able to host my mentor as well as possibly go to his location as well. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Xu Mei Yun. I'm the state chronic disease epidemiologist for the state of Missouri. I manage all chronic disease surveillance, epidemiology, and program evaluations. It's a great pleasure for me to introduce my mentee, Lamiz El-Sadek. Lamiz is an epidemiologist and a program evaluator for Mississippi 1305 program. She graduated from Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health with a Master of Health Science degree. During her graduate and undergraduate studies, she received many honors. I have to have a list here to look at it to remember all those, including a Fulbright Scholar and Albert Schweitzer Fellow, Susan G. Coleman trainee, and also she is also a frequent writer for Huffington Post. Lamiz.
Good morning, everyone. Again, I'm Lamiz El-Sadek, one of the chronic disease epidemiologists and evaluators at the Mississippi State Department of Health. First, I want to thank all of you for the opportunity to present on the process of my ongoing year-long CSTE Mentee project, the creation of a Mississippi State Department of Health diabetes burden document, which is being conducted under the mentorship of Dr. Xu Mei Yun, again, the Missouri State Disease Epidemiologist. So before I dive into the actual process of my CSTE project, I thought it would be helpful to give some context to the state in which I serve. So Mississippi is a vastly rural state. We have about 3 million people, and 2.8 million of those live in rural communities. We have the second highest black prevalence in the country, so a high racial minority population, and we are tied for the most obese state with West Virginia, and about 35% of adult Mississippians are obese. 17% of our state is uninsured, and 34% of our kids live in poverty. 48% of our kids live in single-parent homes, the second highest after D.C. So I share this background to give a glimpse into the pervasiveness of poverty and limited opportunity that may lay the pathway for a disproportionately heavy chronic disease burden on the people of Mississippi. So it's not without surprise that we see the third highest diabetes prevalence in the nation after West Virginia and Alabama in Mississippi. About 12.9% of our adults have been diagnosed with diabetes or self-report being diagnosed with diabetes. And that's equal to about 290,000 adults. And an estimated triple that number are estimated to have prediabetes or be at risk for diabetes. So now that I've shared a little of what Mississippi circumstances look like, I'll briefly present what the staff and resources working against diabetes look like. There are two chronic disease dual role EPIs and evaluators that serve the 1305 grant that many of you may be familiar with. And we serve diabetes, heart disease and stroke, school and physical health, injury and violence prevention programs. My fellow epidemiologist evaluator and I both serve all aforementioned programs, but we have specific programs that we're responsible for, and the Diabetes Prevention and Control Program is what I'm responsible for. And this is an asset, so all of these programs are housed under the Office of Preventive Health, but we sit in the Office of Health Data and Research, which houses all of the data analysts. So sitting together with other data analysts is an asset because you can easily access them, but just because you sit with them doesn't mean that you have the time to access their strengths. And so that's the benefit, or the greatest strength I saw from this mentorship program, is that it provided a designated outlet to learn and to grow. So as background to my project, this project was born out of a desire to, one, clearly understand the severity and scope of the diabetes problem to best leverage our data, two, to have an easy to understand and go-to reference to communicate both internally within the agency and also externally to stakeholders, and also a realization that the last diabetes burden document was put out 5 years ago. So after discussing my desires, my needs, Dr. Yoon's expertise, and the program's needs, we agreed that creating, publishing, and disseminating a burden document would help actualize all of the competencies that we identified. And these competencies fell into four overarching themes: planning, analytical knowledge, informatics, and communication. And there were three goals total, and they ranged from identifying what is it exactly that goes into a burden document to what data systems may exist out there that I may not have already been aware of, to just increasing my ease and comfortability with using state statistical software, to learning how to most effectively communicate data. So, to give a brief overview of my methods, after identifying a burden document as the project that would meet all these needs, Dr. Yoon and I created a work plan and revised it and recreated it, and we included all of the data sources that I would need to request or that I would need to access. I discussed this with my diabetes program to make sure that I was including all of the measures that they were interested in looking at as well. And the general process is I used three general data systems: hospital discharge data, BRFSS, and vital records. I will do analysis, narration, and visualization or graphics for each section. So we don't have enough time to get into results of the analysis, but here are just a snapshot of what's included in the document and not presented here. I will also include cost analysis, discharge rates, trend analysis, and I guess you can consider this a byproduct result, but I've also been able to publish a couple of abstracts in conferences using data I wouldn't have looked at if it wasn't for this project. So I'm told to stop. But just to summarize, I've learned a lot from this mentorship experience, lots of technical knowledge. I'm really grateful to Dr. Yoon. She's been excellent about communicating on a weekly basis and having that ongoing communication, regardless of how hectic the week is, and making it seem like an organic experience rather than a scheduled experience. And rather than just the analytic knowledge and technical knowledge I've learned, I've also learned how important it is to have a mentorship relationship so early in our careers. So thank you to Dr. Yoon and to all my colleagues.
Good morning. Shall we stand up for 5 seconds, please?
Good idea. Great idea.
Dismissed. I'm Juan Carlos Ceballos. I am an cardiovascular epidemiologist, a physician, a cardiologist, but the most wonderful title has been to be a mentor of this program. I'm in Miami at Florida International University, and it's my distinguished privilege to introduce Waqas Humayun, who is at Virginia working as a chronic disease epidemiologist. He will address a very, very important area, something that every county or group of counties demand desperately, the need for data. So, welcome, Waqas.
So I have a lot to cover and I don't want to be stopped, so I will be rushing through a little bit because I do have a lot to cover. So the goal of our project was to calculate smaller estimates of diabetes behavioral risk factor surveillance system and develop a dashboard as a way to disseminate the information that I'm collecting and calculating. So this is a map of Virginia. So a bit about Virginia, it has about 8 million, and of those approximately 650,000 people are self-reported diabetics through BRFSS. And this is from the 2013 BRFSS survey. This information is great for CDC. They can use this map or the state number to figure out where they need to spend their money and resources. It's also great for the state of Virginia at the state health department to be able to figure out which health districts, which LHDs the money needs to go to and resources need to go to. But what do the LHDs themselves do once the resources are provided to them? Where do they target their resources to get the biggest bang for their buck, get the biggest return on their investment? So that's the dilemma we are dealing with. So the next question is, well, what are we doing about it? So the goal was, again, to calculate smaller estimations. So that's what we're doing about it. So we need to fill this data need. So as part of my mentorship, this was my goal. The idea was to analyze BRFSS using smaller estimation, which is currently in progress, and then be able to display results from smaller estimation using a dashboard or some dashboard mechanism. In this case, we are choosing Tableau because Virginia Department of Health recently procured Tableau licenses. And this can also be displayed on the website. And lastly, once we learn the smaller estimation technique, the idea is to be able to use this platform and extend it to other surveys like WIRE, BS, and PRAM so that other surveys can also benefit from the overall smaller estimation technique. And lastly, it is cost effective. So if we don't have enough, if the funding gets cut or gets smaller or the dollars shrink, then we have this ability to still be able to churn out regional or local estimates in the future. So how are we doing that? Well, so we used BRFSS data for 2013 and American Community Survey 5-year estimates from 2009 to 2013 from the U.S. Census Bureau, and the variables we selected based on literature were age, sex, race, and 150% below federal poverty by county. We used our BRFSS sample. We used our BRFSS survey to analyze this, and total sample size was 7,335 after exclusions of missing data. And following is the model that we created. It's actually an adaptation of a model that Zhang and colleagues from CDC presented, and they used very similar variables to present their data on COPD, but we just adopted it, and adopted their model, which was for national level, and just condensed it down to the state level. And we also got their SAS code to do the Markov chain Monte Carlo simulation. and we will be hopefully getting that done soon and presenting it at least to NACED later. Then the next point is, the next step would be to be able to show it. So this is sort of the dashboard that we've created. This is actually a, this itself is not a live dashboard, this is just a screenshot of it, but we actually have created a live dashboard that is functional. So the dashboard allows somebody who's a program person, program coordinator, disease manager, to be able to look at their health district in relative to other health districts or relative to other counties within the state of Virginia, compare their particular county with other counties and their health rankings. So we used a Robert Wood Johnson Foundation's county health rankings, and those are plotted there in the bar chart. And along with that, we have the BRFSS data currently that is at the health district level or the LH local health department level. And once we have the smaller estimates, we'll be able to give county level estimates for all of those. And we also have a map, we also have a graph over time with changes depending on which county you select. So you can really, it's very personalized to a particular county or to a particular health district. So in order to give them an opportunity to play around with the data that they have in a very intimate manner so that they can really be the ones, if they have a question, they can get it answered by themselves rather than sending us the data requests and having that lag time in planning. And once this is the overall extent of it. So basically our next steps are to finalize the analysis. We are halfway through with that, and then be able to compare the direct estimates with our current analysis to be able to validate them, and then just create the dashboard, and that's all. Sorry, it was a bit much.
Just don't time.
Okay, great. Thanks.
By the end, we'll figure out how this unravels.
Good morning. My name is Hafiz Rahman, and I'm an epidemiologist supervisor at the Houston Health Department. And it's a pleasure to introduce my mentee, Sarah Marco. She works with the Sonoma County Health Department as a chronic epidemiologist, and she's working on a very important issue, which is a prescription drug abuse. She's been using a number of data to look at the problem in the county. Please welcome.
Good morning, everyone. So I'm going to describe the prescription drug use and abuse in Sonoma County as quickly as I can in 5 or 7 minutes. So for those of you who don't know, Sonoma County is in the San Francisco Bay Area. We're the most northern county in the Bay Area, and we're the largest county. We have a population of about 500,000. And we're a semi-rural county with a strong agricultural industry, primarily wine, grape growing, and producing. So, as I'm sure you all know, prescription drug abuse is a major public healthcare, and public health safety problem nationally. From 1993 or 1999 to 2013, the drug poisoning, the rate of drug poisoning deaths due to prescriptions has doubled, and those involving opioid analgesics has nearly quadrupled in that time period. And in California, we see from 2006 to 2012 that deaths involving prescription opioids has increased about 17% from 2006 to 12. To date, there have been efforts in Sonoma County to address this problem, but they've been fairly uncoordinated and disparate efforts. So we decided that we needed Sonoma County specific data to guide our response, our health department's response. So my competencies that I was that I'm interested in is analytical knowledge and communication. So there are a total of 4 epidemiologists in my health department, and there's great peer-to-peer learning, but what I think this mentorship has really added is having Hafiz as a senior-level epidemiologist be able to provide technical support. So I don't have, or we don't have at my health department, a supervisor who's trained as an epidemiologist. So having his guidance has been really important. So I said we want to understand the problem of prescription drugs in our community, particularly opioids, and I work in the Division of Health Policy Planning and Evaluation, and so all our work is really based around looking at social determinants of health and doing place-based work when possible. So as much as I can with our prescription drug data sources, I'll be working with these frameworks. So I will be analyzing data from multiple data sources listed here. So our prescription drug monitoring program data we just received last week. I've been working with the multiple cause of death data files, your traditional hospital discharge and emergency department data, our emergency medical services, EMS data, looking for naloxone administrations is another indicator of heroin and prescription drug abuse, and then also doing some analyses with our risk behavioral data from our youth survey. And these analyses are conducted in SAS, and I don't really have time to touch on the methodologies for all of them, but essentially New York City developed a technical assistance manual for prescription drugs, and so that I'm using some of their methodologies. I've been in conversation with New York City epidemiologists who've done very similar analyses with some people at the state, our local community partners, our health department staff, our physician groups are all sort of informing these analyses. So this just shows, this is not even specific to opioids, but this is our drug poisoning death rates in Sonoma County in California over time. And I just wanted to show this so you can see change over time. So for both Sonoma County and California, the rate of drug poisoning deaths has increased significantly over the time period, and Sonoma County has a significantly higher rate than the state. This is the rate of unintentional hospitalization from opiates, Sonoma County and California. And again, similar to the other slide, for both Sonoma County and California, our rates have increased significantly over the time, and Sonoma County is higher than the state. And then just another perspective, so this is showing prevalence of non-medical prescription painkillers to get higher stoned among Sonoma County youth, and this is looking at percentage of students with a lifetime recreational use of prescription drugs by grade, and that's students at non-traditional schools, so there's continuing schools or chartered schools. So many of the analyses are ongoing. Data have and will continue to identify various at-risk populations. So some things that I'm really hopeful about is that with our prescription drug monitoring data, which we just received, we learned in 2014 there are over 440,000 prescriptions for opioids in our county. We have a population of about 500,000. There were 120,000 unique people who received those. I'm going to analyze that data, and that data will really inform. There's a primary care provider physician work group that wants to develop guidelines in the primary care setting, so that's going to inform that work. And then once they complete those guidelines, they're going to take it to our emergency department. So that's one way I think we're really going to influence policy. Another analysis I'm really excited about is our multiple cause of death analysis. So we're going to look at if there are any other major health conditions associated with opioid death from opioid overdose. We're also going to link some of our Medicaid data to look at what factors predict the pharmacy and medical databases to see what factors may predict hospitalizations or ED visits due to prescription opioid abuse or misuse. So thank you all, and happy to take questions later.
Well, my name is Yu Zhuang. I come from Atlanta, Georgia. My mentee is Brittany Murray. She is working with Nevada Department of Health and Human Resources. And her project is a very unique project. And a lot of surprise, a lot, you know, exciting moment. So Brittany did a great job, you know, go through all the process. I let Brittany to introduce her project and the experience.
All right, thank you, Yuchi, for that. So, as you said, I'm Brittany Mori. I am with the Division of Public and Behavioral Health in Nevada on 1305, the Community Health Worker Program, and our HIV Wellness Initiative, which is what I'll be speaking to you about today. So the focus of my project was to collect and analyze data that would look at chronic disease within our HIV population in northern Nevada. And the whole reason would be to produce a report or several reports that could be used by community health partners to improve on care and prevention efforts regarding chronic disease in this population. So to give you a little bit of background, 19% of people living with HIV were aged 55 and older in 2010. So due to improvements in medical care, our HIV population is living longer, which is amazing. However, as they live longer into older age, we are seeing the onset of chronic disease, which, of course, they're getting older. But also, we're looking at things, or the literature has looked at things such as HIV progression, treatment toxicity, and modifiable risk factors, all relating to this increase of chronic disease within that population. So chronic diseases that you will typically see are osteoporosis, cardiovascular disease, COPD, renal disease, cancer, and type 2 diabetes. Because I work with the section of chronic disease prevention and health promotion, what I'm focusing on are these modifiable risk factors. And within this population, we see a high prevalence of things like cigarette smoking, recreational drug use, increased alcohol intake, and reduced physical activity, which are all, of course, going to have an impact on chronic disease. So in Nevada, we are only just beginning to go down this path. So 22% of people living with HIV in Nevada are aged 55 years and older. And we know from our HIV registry in the state that we have approximately 10,000 cases of HIV and AIDS. So we have data from our HIV registry that tells us what our HIV population looks like. And we have our chronic disease data from BRFSS. What we don't have is anything connecting these two. That is what my project is focusing on, is linking these two areas together so we have a picture of what's going on. So in an effort to begin this whole process, I contacted our state registry for HIV. They told us we don't have any of that. We collect HIV data linked with tuberculosis, hepatitis, but nothing linking with chronic disease. And we're sorry, even if we did have that data, even though we work for the state just like you do in the same division, we would not be able to share that with you for privacy concerns. So I don't think there's any surprise there. They would be able to run analysis for us, but we would not be able to get the data ourselves. And so then I turned to hospital discharge data, thinking that maybe that would be helpful. However, we don't have any unique identifiers in our hospital discharge data, which means that we cannot deduplicate that data, and we also would not be able to link it to the HIV database. So from there, I turned to Northern Nevada HOPES as another source of data. They are our state's AIDS service organization that is also a federally qualified health center, and they serve our underserved population, so elderly, underinsured, uninsured, homeless. They're kind of a one-stop shop. So after a somewhat lengthy process with Northern Nevada HOPES, we were able to get a data use agreement and get a data transfer from them in this past May. And so that data covered April 2014 to April 2015.
The chronic diseases that came with, in that data set were type 2 diabetes, COPD, hypertension, colon cancer, and arthritis. And other variables included age, sex, ethnicity, zip code, the patient number, BMI, and tobacco use status. So some limitations were that after the deduplication, it was really a small sample size, and we had no comparison group. So we didn't have, we only had their patients who had HIV and a chronic disease. We didn't have their entire HIV patient population, or their entire population at all. So this leads me to lessons learned. Relationship building and gaining trust is a very important part of the process, especially when you have HIV data. So our wellness manager, Melanie Flores, she's actually the person who created our HIV wellness initiative, and she has a long-lasting relationship with Northern Nevada Hopes. So she got us in the door. She got the in-person meeting. We sat down with them, discussed a collaboration, and got our data use agreement signed and approved by their board. Next, you have to sell your project. You can't just ask people for their data without getting something in return. Of course, that's not what we're in public health to do. So Northern Nevada Hopes does not have the epic capacity to look at this data. So we can do that for them. And then we can, together as a team from there, come up with solutions or help them improve their patient care within this population. Data use agreements must be very explicit, and data needs should be very clearly communicated. I learned that. That's a very important lesson. And gathering the data you want will take time, patience, and a lot of communication. And as always, have a plan B. This project actually was my plan B. So with that, we have some next steps, which include continuing to have this discussion with Northern Nevada Hopes, get more data that will cover their entire HIV population or their entire patient population, and then write some reports for them and begin working on improving their patient care. So thank you very much to NACDD for this opportunity. Thank you tremendously to UG, and thank you to all of you for being here today.
Good morning. My name is Kathy Brown. I am an associate professor at the University of Tennessee Department of Public Health, and it is my great pleasure to introduce you to my mentee, Mabel Owusu-Ankuma, and she is a chronic disease epidemiologist in the state of West Virginia. And when Mabel took her position, she found herself to be, and she's going to tell you a little bit more about this, but in a department where, as we hear, it is not of the given that there is a senior epidemiologist who can mentor and bring along. But what Mabel did have was significant support, which I clearly found when I did my site visit, from her supervisor as well as from her other team members. The other thing that Mabel has that made this, that completes the picture, makes it successful, is drive and commitment, enthusiasm, an energy that will rival anyone's. So formula for success, or recipe for success, I'll bring Mabel on up here.
Thank you, Dr. Brown. So West Virginia, the wild and wonderful, that's our state's motto. It has a population of 1.8 million, and it's a unique state in that is the only state entirely situated in the Appalachian region. So most of our state is rural, as Brittany would alluded to Nevada. Our state also ranks number one for several chronic diseases as well as the associated risk factors. My division, Health Promotion Chronic Disease, aims to advocate for chronic disease prevention and management. Before I get to this, I just want to give a little bit of history about my division. So similar to most of your states or territories, our division approached chronic diseases by the disease-specific categorical funding. And with that, epidemiologists were housed in our Health Statistics Center and allotted to each program manager as a disease-specific epidemiologist. But with the adoption of the CDC's coordinated chronic disease approach, as most of our states and territories adopted, that shift and the limitations in funding resulted in that unit dissolving. And so for the first time in 12 years, my division was left with no dedicated epidemiologist. And so I started May of last year as the first in-house epidemiologist. So therefore, leading us to this project, Why Data Repository. While it had been a long-standing desire of our leadership to have a repository, therefore, having this mentorship program and their first in-house epidemiologist afforded them that ability. Once this is created, the goal is to first share it with division staff, then share with Bureau for Public Health agencies, and ultimately we really want this accessible to the general public and our stakeholders on our website. So I chose planning and these skills as my competency and my goal. Like I said, until a month ago, I was the sole epidemiologist for my division. And I wear a lot of different hats. So I do evaluation, I do surveillance. I work with comprehensive cancer, 1305 projects, as many of you are familiar with, and whatever else is needed. And so with that, I chose, with communication with my mentor, these as my areas of focus to be able to multitask and balance this diverse workload without feeling overwhelmed, which I was a little bit when I first started. To start this process of developing this repository, I had several conversations with my mentor, my supervisors, some of the FEs who were around, and as well as my division staff to find out what exactly they wanted in the data repository. I also had the opportunity to converse with one of the past mentees who's in Arizona who did a similar project last year. With this, I looked at several literature reviews. I looked at some of the chronic disease indicators the CDC published. Another goal I wanted, and with this, I developed a spreadsheet. With a spreadsheet, we wanted to populate it with data sources, with also our performance measures and chronic disease indicators. Another goal I had for this project was to develop a relationship with mentees working on similar projects as I am. So I've had several biweekly calls and monthly calls with some of the mentees who have already presented, and I think we've all found the relationship to be mutually beneficial. This is just a sample of my spreadsheet, and I apologize that you can't see it clearly in the back. Just a snapshot. We have data sources. I have a description of the data source. Talking with our communications person, we decided it was very useful to include notes and also the website so that others can follow along. Not everybody in my division, almost nobody in my division, has an epi background, and so except now the epidemiologist. Secondly, as you see here, some of you with 1305 was a little bit blurry over there. It's populated with our performance measures, chronic disease indicators. I've linked them with the kind of grants that we're working on. And also, one key thing is the type of measure. So the whole idea is to request data, to populate it with prevalence, incidence, mortality rates, so that it's there, it's easy, and I don't have to be the sole person providing this information. Next steps you see here, I'm currently working on that data request. And as I get information, I populate this data source. Again, we will hopefully ultimately be putting it online so that our stakeholders and our public can access this. So a special thanks to Dr. Brown, who has been phenomenal. Like she said, with that adoption of everything, I had nobody. And she's just been tremendous. Just a great, just wealth of wisdom. And everybody who met her from my division applauds her. They admire her. And I can't wait to do a reverse side visit. A great special thanks to CDC and ACDD also for this opportunity. And thank you, guys.
Good morning. My name is Erica Welsh. I'm the Senior Chronic Disease Epidemiologist in the Bureau of Health Promotion at the Kansas Department of Health and Environment. And I've had the pleasure of working with Leah Shulman from the Vermont Department of Health over the last several months. And Leah will be talking with you today about her work to evaluate the Vermont Comprehensive Cancer Control Program and Vermonters Taking Action Against Cancer.
Thank you for that introduction, Erica.
So as Erica mentioned, I'm going to be talking about the evaluation planning process that I've been undergoing with our Comprehensive Cancer Control Program, which I may refer to as Comp Cancer. For those who don't know, Comp Cancer Program is funded by the CDC and tasked with creating and maintaining a state cancer coalition. In Vermont, this is Vermonters Taking Action Against Cancer, or VTAC, and also with creating and maintaining and implementing a state cancer plan designed to reduce the burden of cancer in our state. A little bit of background in terms of how evaluation has taken place with our Comp Cancer program in Vermont. When it became a CDC requirement to spend 10% of our funding on evaluation in the last grant cycle in 2012, we engaged external contractors to do the evaluation planning and the evaluation implementation in a 3-year plan, which will be ending this year at the end of the calendar year of 2015. While they've done some really great work, there have been some challenges. Our coalition members have had limited involvement, which has meant that there's been a lack of buy-in, and all the recommendations that come, especially when they're specifically directed at coalition structure and activities, comes as kind of is perceived as an external criticism. There's also been the issue of the report formatting. They send our evaluators send really long and technical reports, which are great for me, but are very difficult to disseminate among our stakeholders. And this kind of contributes to this issue of this external criticism perception. And due to the constraints of working within a contract, there's limited flexibility. So for our next round of evaluation, the implementation of which will start in 2016, the Comp Cancer Program had a desire to bring this capacity in-house. And that means me. So that's how I got involved in the mentorship program, because my division just does not have a lot of resources in terms of evaluation planning. There hasn't been a lot of experience. And so Erica was assigned to me as my mentor, and she's been really helpful in creating a 5-year evaluation plan. The first step of this planning process was to reinvigorate a committee that really existed in name only in the VTAC coalition structure, the Evaluation Committee, which had not existed for several years. So the first step was to engage people to participate in that committee. So I invited everybody to participate, and then I did some targeted recruitment to get members to join us from our State Cancer Center, our largest private insurer, our State Cancer Coalition coordinator, and the coordinator for the Survivorship Network, which is a cancer support group, network of cancer support groups that Vermont's Comp Cancer Program supports financially. And, of course, we have representation from our cancer programs. So the next step was to sort of create a variety of draft documents that, through this sort of iterative process, we've had 3 meetings so far with the evaluation committee, and to get everything done in a quickly and timely manner, I've had to do a lot of drafting of documents, and then we kind of tear them apart during the meetings, and then I redraft them, and then I get sort of final approval, and then we move on. Through this process, I've created a variety of documents, including a new logic model, evaluation questions. I drafted a bunch of potential activities, which the committee talked about, and then were laid out in an evaluation planning matrix for the next 5 years. Our next product will be a dissemination plan that we're going to be working on at our meeting in July. If you're curious about any of the details, there are copies of the logic model and the evaluation planning matrix at the back somewhere. Yes, over there. So if you're interested, and I will be here afterwards if you'd like to talk about them, to me about them. In terms of how this process has worked, there have been some advantages and some disadvantages to this sort of inclusive evaluation planning process. You may have heard the phrase that a camel is a horse designed by committee. And you know what? I think this is true. But I don't think it's a bad thing. If you're going to be running around a track, maybe you don't want a camel. But sometimes you don't know where you're going. You're going off into the wilderness, and maybe it's a desert, and maybe that camel is exactly what you need. To that end, I've experienced some advantages going into this process with the committee's support. that they know they've been, I have people there who have been there for 15 years. They've been there since VTAC started. They've been there since Comp Cancer started. So they really know the lay of the land. They have a much better familiarity with the programs, the challenges we've faced. And so we've had great buy-in. I've gained multiple perspectives, greater institutional knowledge, and we've really created a plan that is relevant to our partners' needs and desires. Our disadvantages, of course, it's been a little slower. It's required a lot of legwork by me to create all these draft documents and then be willing and able to redraft them, which has definitely required some personal growth on my part to be willing to, you know, compromise sort of something I put a lot of work into and then have it torn down a little bit. But so that's been excellent personal growth. And there is some, you know, different skill sets among the different participants, which means sometimes it can take a little while to sort of get everybody up to speed. The plan will be revised in 2.5 years for a mid-year revision, and it is somewhat flexible. In terms of the implementation of the plan, ideally the primary work will be done by me in terms of at least all the quantitative work, hopefully. And for the qualitative work, I will oversee either internal evaluators or external contractors to do very small particular qualitative pieces. And then just very briefly, how this EPI mentoring program has helped me. Erica has been a sounding board for everything I've created. She's helped me to think about how to approach difficult conversations to have during some of these meetings, and provided an outside perspective without a programmatic agenda. And finally, she's been able to encourage the capacity building internally within my division of evaluation capacity for planning and implementation through her site visit and then follow-up calls with division leadership. So thank you all. Thank you, Erica. Thank you to NACDD for this opportunity. And do I take questions now?
We'll take.
So if you can, so this is the part that we open up for question and answer. If you have specific questions from the mentee or mentor, please voice them, and we will ask the individuals to come forward or get to the microphone to respond to you.
Hi, my name is Michelle. I have a question for the individual that presented on the HIV. So I'm interested in something that we've been looking at in Indiana, and I think it's something that we need to do more with chronic and special populations. So are you working with your HIV program to maybe implement some of those variables into your surveillance system moving forward, collecting more of those chronic variables such as HIV and AIDS and hypertension? Yes.
Do you mind repeating the question and on the microphone, please, because it's recorded. So.
So that is something that our initiatives want to talk internally about, because actually our HIV registry is down in Las Vegas, so we are not close to them. We don't work very closely side by side with them. So that is something we plan to talk to them about. So right now, we're really just focusing on getting things squared away with Northern Nevada Hopes. And if our HIV registry doesn't have the ability or the buy-in to do something like that at this time, we're also hoping that when we get our state-run health exchange up and going, which we're working on with our FQHCs right now, that we might be able to implement that there with them.
So I would love to talk to you afterwards and hear from you again. That's something that you want to look at in Indiana.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Juan?
Oh. My question is directed back to you.
Do you mind asking me the microphone? Thank you.
Given that you use the VR business data to link with the other registries, how did you overcome the IRB issue in the fact that as VR business data is anonymous, so with the potential of linking it to an individual? Because we're thinking of doing something similar with TB, and that's the question that has been thrown at me, and I'm just wondering how you went through that. Because when you talk to a respondent on VRFSS, you tell them their information is anonymous, and here we go again and link it with the HIV registry or TB registry. How do we navigate that?
So I actually were not using BRFSS for it. It's like going so fast, it's really hard to explain that very well. So we're not. So with Northern Nevada Hopes, we're just using their data out of their electronic medical record system. So we're just strictly, because what they are is they actually started out as an AIDS organization, AIDS service organization. They became an FKHC in 2013. So they started collecting chronic disease data in 2013. So we are just working strictly with them right now.
Brittany, I have a question. So, you might try to use BRFS data. I can ask at a state at a question. I don't know your state BRFS sample size. So you can add a question about your HIV status. And then you will have HIV status and the chronic disease indicators, and, you know, behavior, risk behaviors, all those data together. But I don't know your state BRFS sample size.
Yes, so we actually, we got the same thing. We're like, oh, it'll be in there. And then we went and looked at it, and the only question that we have right now is, have you been screened for HIV? That's something you need to talk to our BRFSS coordinator about. Thank you.
I have a pledge and a question. Please talk to NACDD to remove the blue ribbons and the green row from the slides. I mean, I know that we talked about that, but we should do something about it. The EIS officers always promote. It's a kind. The message is relatively difficult to receive. The tables were difficult in many of the presentations, so we should remove black and white to explain the message is getting. So I'm sorry to bring this up, but I was really disturbed about it, distracted about that. And the second thing is I have a question for Scott. I truly hope that you are not using the STEP as designed by the WHO for the selection of your sample. I hope so. Okay. That's a relief, because for the people, they use quotas. They do not approve the sample. And it's terrible, and it's a pity that it's endorsed by the WHO to do that. I'm so glad.
Well, Juan, I think you must be a very special artist. So you must have your hands in art, because visually, sometimes things don't disturb some people, but disturb the artist. So you must be that artist.
Well, I just consider myself an artist.
Very artistic.
So I was just going to make one statement, and then we'll go on with more further questions and answers. Isn't that wonderful to take you through a journey internationally from subtropical Florida all the way to tropical Samoa, and then to Texas, the land of wild and free, and or was it West Virginia? I can't remember. And the land of our ancestry in Virginia, as well as Nevada, as well as Vermont, the beautiful fall season in Vermont. It's only possible when you create a program or a concept that enables the states to improve their capacity and recruit the individuals to participate and create a tour like that. So you have taken this tour in about an hour, and so I enjoyed my tour. I learned a lot about other states that I would have not known otherwise. Luis?
I just wanted to add some comments reflecting on the mentorship program. I began with the program in 2011. And I've seen it grow, and it was last year that for the first time we had the opportunity to present data through a poster session. And I think that this is the first time that I think we were given space to present all the projects. And I want to tell you, I'm so impressed with the work, the depth, where the epidemiologists are in their development, and I feel how meaningful that program, the interaction, we call it capacity. But in fact, what it is, it's developing people's skills, their interests, their abilities, and my view is that that's the most valuable thing that the program imparts. It's such a joy to see everyone present such valuable work, and I just was absolutely delighted.
Thank you, Luis. Appreciate it. So, yes, please. Do you mind walking up to the microphone? Thank you.
Hi, I'm Dela Cash. I'm the NCD Regional Epidemiologist for the USAPI, the U.S. Affiliated Pacific Islands. And I think this program is really great, and I enjoyed everybody's presentation, so thank you. And I just want to say that I would love to see more support out in the Pacific and our other territories, the U.S. Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico. I think that this program could be really beneficial out there, and there are a lot of folks that could really use it, like our new epidemiologist, Molly, and that's all.
Thank you. So one of the comments, of course, you know, we're going to go to the announcement in about a couple of minutes. One of the things that we have not done a good justice in today's presentation is recognize and appreciate the mentors. And I think in the past, we've not had a chance to do that. But so since we are at the end of our 5 years implementation, I would very much like to specifically take the time to recognize the individuals and their contribution and the length of time that they've been with us. So Luis, thank you very much for being part of our game. Erica, thank you very much for your contribution, for supporting Yuji. It is always a pleasure to see you and a great contribution to our pool of mentors. Juan, thank you again. I think without you guys, this program would have not been possible. Kathy, again, thank you. Shimei, welcome to the mentoring program. This is an opportunity for you to learn as well. And Hafiz, thank you again. Anne, thank you again. So these are the two individuals who've been with us off and on, and particularly who is in Hawaii. She used to be a chronic disease director, chronic disease epidemiologist with the Hawaii Health Department for about 10, 11 years, back to the university, and now she's without a mentorship. So our pool of mentors are expanding. Recognizing, okay, so I did mention Erica. Thank you, Erica. So our pool of mentors are expanding, and that is also a good sign of a healthy, sustainable program. The fact that our mentors keep up with their field and they stay all the way up to date with what's going on is a healthy sign of a program that will thrive. So if you would have stayed behind and worried about still paperwork processes, that would have been kind of concerning. But the fact that you're up there and you're reading and you're keeping up with what's going on with CDC is the asset that we all count on. So from my part, I appreciate your presence. And finally, to Geraldine Perry, who is our CDC project officer, as well as director of this program, we thank you for your support word of wisdom. Every time we turn around, we have problems. Geraldine comes up and say, well, how about this? And so we always listen to what she has to say. Any comment, any question from the audience? Because I need to turn it to Natasha, because she has some good stuff to share with us. Natasha?
The announcement, the where we need to go from here and all that.
Hi.
Hi, everyone. Natasha McCoy, Public Health Consultant for the National Association of Chronic Disease Directors, and I just want to repeat what Khosro and my colleagues have said here. It's just, this has been incredible. It's just the opportunity. I've been a part of the program for a little over a year now. It's been this is my second cohort. I kind of inherited half of the year from the last one. But this has been absolutely eye-opening experience for me because I came from the State Health Department as well before I started working with the National Association of Chronic Disease Directors, and I knew what was the stressors that were placed upon the chronic disease epidemiologist, and just being a part of this program, seeing things from both perspectives, from Dr. Perry as the funder, from Khosro's from a senior chronic disease epi level, and from our mentors and mentees. So I just am always impressed by the amount of work that's completed by our mentees. We've started, they literally started the project 5 months ago, and we see the products of everything they've done in 5 months. And we're talking about establishing the relationships with their mentors as well. And when I sit here and see our mentees and mentors talking amongst each other and seeing each other, it's amazing to see what was achieved in such a short amount of time. So I certainly congratulate all of you on your success to this day. And it's especially letting you know that we continue to have 3 months of the project, so no stress if you didn't finish your actual product. Progress. That there's 3 more months under this project umbrella. We gave a bit of information yesterday to our mentees and mentors that we have the ability for them to travel to their mentor's place of employment. One of the standard pieces of the project is allowing the mentors to travel to their mentees' side of employment, giving the mentors, and I think it's really great because it gives the mentors an actual opportunity to see what's going on in their mentees' place of employment, to see the environment they work in, the space they work in, the products, the tools they work with, and being able to come in as a senior advisor level and informing that mentee supervisor of what could be done or could be provided to that mentee. And sometimes, you know, it happens that the mentee themselves, you know, you're an employee. Sometimes you may not be able to express yourself in that way. So having this mentor-mentee relationship, I think, gives a greater voice to our mentees, allowing you to be able to ask for what you want and have someone there supporting you and being able to provide and help get that resource to you. Also, through the National Association of Chronic Disease Directors, we have the great pleasure of, you know, we're working through final logistics, to say officially, contingent on final funding, but having the opportunity to provide this program again for another year. And so in the next month and a half or so, we should be providing more information to those of you. So if you'd like to leave us your contact information, name and email address, we'd be very happy to let you know the period has been open again for next year's mentee cohort. And we especially encourage all of our current mentees, if you wouldn't mind sharing the information to help us recruit the next cohort as well. Yeah. So congratulations and thank you. Excellent job today.
So you guys know that the real driving force behind all of this is Natasha. So if you are here as a potential next cohort mentee, in other words, how do you apply for this? And this is what Natasha alluded to. You can get some information online from NACDD's web pages. Just search for Applied Mentoring Epidemiologist Program. Do you have any handouts? Do we have any handouts available?
There are handouts on the seat that has my contact information. Yes, right there. Yes, and even on this this sheet, it also has my email address. If there was not a blue sheet on your chair.
So if you wonder what does it take in order to apply, it's very simple. There's a form that you fill out with your self-assessed competency, get a couple of letters of support, one from your immediate supervisor and one from the state designated public health officer, to make sure that everybody is in line with the concept, submit it, it'll be reviewed, and you'll be notified of your status. Now, if you're here, as a potential mentor, and you haven't done mentoring for, you've done mentoring maybe locally, but you'd like to join us, please submit your resume, a letter that indicates your strength and how you can contribute to this, and we'll be happy to review it. There is a steering committee that review both applications and render decisions, and we usually notify the individuals within a reasonable time. So, Geraldine, any last pearl of wisdom you would like to share with the rest of us?
No last minute. I just want to thank all the presenters for being on time and staying within you a long time. And a great presentation.
Yeah, so thank you very much for coming, and I appreciate it.